I do not represent HL7. I'm yelling. It's okay. I'm the only person who's brave enough to sit up here and do this talk. So that's why I'm here. My personal background really has no bearing on why I'm here. So you throw things, I'm prepared.
But her name is Reed Ellis.
Yeah, it's a lot.
In case there are people who can hear but not see.
It's on the slide, and you know where to find me. So what I'm going to do is really a fact-based presentation as much as possible about what is HL7's intellectual policy right now. And that's the URL for it, so you can go out there and read it for yourself. Truth in presenting. Information in the presentation is based on materials publicly available and some conversations that I have had with HL7 leadership. I'm going to try to do my best to present the facts as I understand them and not my opinions, although I do have opinions. And where I express my opinion, I will indicate that. And the last thing, which you've heard before, is I am not a lawyer. And for specific answers for questions related to circumstances in your own organization, you have to go to your own legal counsel. So this is like, I would not write a prescription for you in this setting. I will not give you legal advice in this setting. So HL7, this is the blurb on their website about who they are, and I wanted to point out a couple of things. One is it's a not-for-profit organization. So in addition to the fact that there's a ton of volunteer work done to create and maintain the HL7 standards, there is an organization that exists that is maintained. It has over 2,300 members, and it represents more than 90% of the information system vendors serving healthcare. Vision and mission, you can go by this. You know, vision statements create the best and most widely used. It's God, motherhood, apple pie. Then we start to get into the harder stuff. This is the legal notice that you get when you go to HL7's website that, and I'm going to highlight some words, the use of HL7's intellectual property, including standards in any format. So, you know, whether you downloaded a Word document or you got the Access database and acquired through any channel. So whether you got them from HL7 directly or your next-door neighbor gave them to you or your grandmother, the rules apply. Doesn't matter how you got them. The products are copyrighted, and we just had that little discussion about copyright and licensing, and are protected by copyright law. Interesting anecdote from my personal experience, I submit the request to our organization every year, to Washington State Department of Health, to renew our membership in HL7 once a year. And up till this past year, when a lot of this legal language was publicly available on the website, I used to have to make a long, complicated argument about why we needed to be a member. And so this was a lot easier, and you know, I just said, we have to be a member, it's legally required. And so the contracts office came back and said, can you show us the Washington state law that says you have to be an HL7 member? And I said, no, it's not Washington state law, it's U.S. copyright law. And they shut up and paid the bill. So.
anyone can use.
Yes. So rights in HL7 depend on your category of membership. So these are the categories. You can see that it starts with individual membership and works up to supporter or benefactors. CDC is a benefactor. And you can see that organizational membership, and I don't know if I can make the little pointer work from here. Yeah, there. This is the 1260 at the bottom is actually, I put a star next to it because you'll see for a second, it's actually a little cheaper for public health organizations. So dues are tiered according to the type of organization and the annual income. So you can see if you're a supplier or a vendor or a payer. It depends on how big you are and your volume and your patient days or whatever. So none of that really applies to most of public health. But if you are a member of one of those organizations, this would apply to you. The number of members assigned to your organization increases in proportion to your membership dues. So the bigger you are, the bigger voice you get. Benefits, in addition to all the benefits of individual membership, which we'll talk about, this is all off the HL7 website. I didn't write this. Multiple members, the ability to transfer membership, and the things that are most important, and I don't know if my next slide highlighted it or not, so I'm not going to go ahead, but multiple copies of the standards and the right to distribute the standards within your organization. Really big point, because we're going to look ahead to individual membership and see that if you're an individual member, you have much more restricted rights. Or if you buy the standard off the HL7 website, you have much more restricted rights. Once you're an organizational member, I can take the standards, I can put them on the share drive at DOH, and anyone within Washington State Department of Health can use them. Big deal. I mean, that's what makes it work in our organization. I did highlight it. There you go. And the right to distribute excerpts of the standard to clients as part of proposals or technical documentation. So if you're working with partners, you can share those, you can share bits of the standard with them as necessary to clarify your work together. And then there's just this other, you know, listing in the organizational member directory, free online job postings, always a benefit.
You slipped by something very quickly, can I ask?
Absolutely, I can try to go back even.
You
there we go.
You may or may not know one more. Is there a definition of client?
Oh, wait, hang on.
Okay.
Not as clear as you might like. So, organizational member logos, yada yada. Public health agencies fall into the government agencies, nonprofit associations, and universities category of membership. So it includes nonprofits, universities, professional societies like maybe CST, although CST is not yet a member, industry consortia, da-da-da-da. Employees only and doesn't extend to the members of the consortia. So at one point we had a conversation at CST, Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, about whether we could have CST become a member and then thereby all the states would become members. All the state public health associations would become members. Won't work under the rules. It doesn't matter what your annual revenue is or how big your budget is, so big and small health departments, same rule. You get one voting member. From my organization, it's me. And the annual dues are about $1,000 a year. They started out a few years ago at $700, $800, and they've been going up about $50 a year ever since. You know how that is. And while I know that it's hard times for public health, I also know that for most of our budgets, $1,000 is decimal dust. Rights of corporate and organizational members. So once you sign up as a public health, in that government and public health category, you're an organizational member, same as GE, only they pay a lot more, so they're actually a benefactor, I think. And here's what they can do. They can reproduce and distribute on an internal basis. They can reproduce and distribute excerpts of the standard, not entire domains or chapters, to any customers. Again, customers, clients, we get into the what's the meaning of the words. Use HL7 standards in the development of software applications and messaging systems for direct use or distribution without additional licensing fees. And I'm going to walk through the legal language first and then come to some not exactly frequently asked questions, because I don't answer questions about HL7 intellectual property typically, but some questions that I've heard and exchanged back and forth with David Jaffe, the CEO of HL7, and others, and some of the answers that I've gotten. So if you've got specific questions, hold tight, because I'm going to walk through the boring boilerplate first. Sorry, I'm not a lawyer for a good reason. This stuff gives me hives. More rights. You get those rights only if the redistribution rights, if you identify the HL7 as the publisher and holder of the copyright, and any modifications of the standards are clearly identified. Sounds a lot like what Mike said, right? Exclusions and prohibitions, you can't do commercial resale of, And the Access database, in case some of you aren't aware of that as an HL7 product, every version 2 standard up through 2.7 now is available in Access database format, which is very handy. We use BizTalk as our parser, and they don't support anything past 2.5 within the parser. Basically, they tell you, go buy the HL7 database, and we can suck it into BizTalk and use it, but we're not going to maintain it in the BizTalk product itself. So the HL7 database is actually a very handy thing. Rights of members, individual members. So let's say you said, bless you, I don't want to be an organizational member, I want to be an individual member. Not really sure why, because the price difference isn't that big and the organizational benefits are so huge. But if you did say, I want to be an individual member, you can access the standards for your personal edification and engage in implementation services that do not include distribution of or access to HL7 standards or excerpts. So if you're a consultant, you might be an individual member, you might help people implement HL7, but you can't hand out the standard. Basically, that's what it says. You can't reproduce. If you're an individual, you can't give it away. Rights of individual members, more individuals. You can't engage in implementation services that include the distribution of the standards or providing client access to the specifications. And that's hard. You're coming as a consultant, you want to hand out things, but the individual license doesn't let you to do that. Rights of non-members ain't much. You can read them for your personal edification, and that is about it. So although at one point I was saying to people, okay, so the ELR guide on the HL7 website, it's $50, just do it. HL7 made it a lot clearer that's not that's generally not going to get you where you need to be for many of our organizations, and I'll try to get a little clearer about that in a second. So basically, there are more exclusions and prohibitions than there are anything else for the non-members. They have no rights to use, reproduce, or distribute the standards. They can't use them in the development of software products. So just because you bought it doesn't mean you can use it. You can read it. That's it. You can sleep with it under your pillow. So now I get to the questions. Does your agency build software that implements HL7? So in our particular shop, we have our own homegrown ELR system. We have our homegrown surveillance system for communicable disease. We have a homegrown syndromic surveillance system. We build that sort of stuff. So in that case, these are the examples: situational awareness, NEDS messaging to CDC. Your agency has to be an HL7 member. Now, it's my reading of the HL7 rules and consistent with the conversations that I've had with HL7 leadership. Does your agency only use software that implements HL7? So a parallel here is the EHR use in an individual clinician's office. And this is an explicit conversation I had with David Jaffe. David. I know a David Jaffe. That's the problem. Black box. It's the idea of the black box. So the software creates or receives HL7 messages or documents in the background. The clinician doesn't know or care how it happens. And if you say to the clinician HL7, they'll say, "What the heck is that?" So they don't know. They're just using a tool that does what they need it to do. In that case, the individual clinician doesn't need to be an HL7 member. The software developer does. And at least at the corporate or organizational level. So, does your agency only use software that implements HL7? The idea of a black box. So maybe the NEDS-based system. Now, you know, I don't get a specific read from a lawyer on any of this, but I'm just trying to extrapolate from what's in the rule. What about the NEDS-based system? Developed by CDC, which is an HL7 organizational member, it's a benefactor, receives ELR messages, it creates, well, sort of creates NEDS messages, or it will. Jurisdictions that only use the NEDS-based system as a tool don't need to be HL7 members. State-developed software that's used by LHJs is in this category. So our communicable disease surveillance system is called FIMS. It's a web-based system. It's used by all the local health jurisdictions in our state. We need to be the HL7 member. We build the software. The LHJs don't. So does your agency build systems that use open source software, sorry, this is my third presentation today, like Mirth and Happy? This is where my conversation with HL7 leadership got a little murky. I didn't have the sense, I like to see Austin nodding, I don't have the sense that they really have a really firm finish on this piece. But think about what open source means. If you're participating in open source, it means that you are in some way, shape, or form a co-developer. And in that case, you know, I think the strict letter of the law would probably say you do need to be a member, but it's still a little bit out there.
Check with your attorney.
Check with your attorney, exactly. What about implementation guides? Hot question. They're balloted. There are some that are balloted through HL7, like the ELRIG and the Public Health Case Reporting Implementation Guide, which we just talked about in the last session. And there are some that are not balloted through HL7, like the Immunization Implementation Guide and the ELR for 231, version 231, and the Syndromic Surveillance Implementation Guide. Does being balloted through HL7 matter? And the answer is not as far as intellectual property issues are concerned. Every implementation guide contains HL7 intellectual property. You write about the MSH segment, you're writing about HL7 intellectual property. You use an HL7 data type like CWE, you're writing about HL7 intellectual property. So it really doesn't matter if it got balloted through HL7 or not. So if you're going to use it in a system where you're building the software, you should be a member. If you're just reading it because, you know, well, somebody's handed you a system and you want to see what it means that they're saying that they're compliant with this implementation guide and you're not hands-on as a developer, you don't need to be a member.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
If I can answer it.
You earlier talked about excerpts of the standard, to reproduce and distribute excerpts of the standard. And taking it, your interpretation, which has all the worth of any of our interpretations, is that an implementation guide is considerably more than an excerpting.
Yes. That would be my interpretation. Austin is nodding as well. There's usually a lot more in an implementation. I would think.
Just kind of checking.
Yeah.
Trying to keep track of the logic.
So, sorry, was there another question? So what about message profiles? This is a hot topic right now because we're developing message profiles for things like that underpin MQF, the message quality frameworks, to support validation. So in HL7 version 2.7, this is the definition of a message profile, an unambiguous specification of one or more standard messages that have been analyzed for a particular use case, and it prescribes a set of precise constraints on the underlying standard. I think you're going to know what the answer to this one is already. Like implementation guides, all message profiles contain HL7 intellectual property. Therefore, if your organization implements a message profile in software you've developed, regardless of who created the profile, your organization does need to be an HL7 member. So again, it comes down to, you know, are you building the stuff, or are you merely passively using something that someone else who should have the license has built? So if you're just using MQF, you don't need a license. So frequently asked question, to which I am not going to provide an answer, why isn't there a US-wide license? Just the leading question that Seth asked for this talk. We support through our tax dollars, and believe me, I am thrilled about that use of my tax dollars. We support LOIC, we support SNOMED for general distribution within the US. Why not HL7? Why isn't there a public health license? I mean, maybe you make the argument that if $1,000 isn't that huge for an organizational member, and a couple thousand dollars isn't that huge for a, you know, large healthcare organization or a vendor, then, well, you know, what about the compassionate use provisions of SNOMED? Maybe we should have a compassionate use provision for HL7 for public health agencies. So what do you do? This is personal advice. Be fair. Creating and maintaining standards is expensive stuff. I mean, this doesn't happen for free, and even if you got a lot of volunteers around the table, the machinery, the organization, buying and maintaining the tooling, the distribution mechanisms, it really costs money, and one way or another it's going to get paid for, whether it's directly out of our memberships or, you know and I know that if it's all the healthcare organizations paying for it, we're going to pay for it anyway in the cost of healthcare. So be legal. Play by the rules as they exist right now. And if you don't like the rules, then I have two pieces of advice. You know, get involved and work for change. So that's the best I can do. I'm not a lawyer, so you can throw things now, and I'm done.
Can I make one comment?
Absolutely.
As a side note, there have been conversations going on between HL7 management and ONC to try and answer and address some of the FAQs that Rita brought up. They haven't come to a conclusion. If you have strong opinions, it would make perfect sense for you to talk to HL7 or more likely ONC and let them know what you need. It won't necessarily solve the problem, but the more information they have, the quicker they should be able to come to a resolution.
And I'll put some of the issues that have emerged that help generate the context, because I think that most of the use cases, if you will, that Rita have discussed are fairly clear. But where we are still wandering into zones where it is not clear. And one is a member like CDC helps either participates in or develops one of these documents. The use of the document requires membership. The use of the product requires membership. Telling people about the product in a way that makes sense then sometimes becomes a gray area. Finally, the issue of does, for example, CDC or other organizations have to be the party that takes extraordinary measures to make sure that no one could either see or, in most cases, use the product
doing those duties on behalf of HL7. So those are some of the issues that have come up that, as likely or not, may have impacted some of you over the last 12 months as we try to muddle through.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Seth, there's also been conversations specifically between CDC and HL7 as well.
We do have those conversations. Well, we're a member.
For the longest time, the HL7 implementation guide, the 2.3.1 implementation guide, was on the CDC website. Is that a violation to download that and distribute that to people that you're trying to do business with?
Well, you made a distinction between 2.3.1 ELR and 2.5.1 ELR on the slide, which I'm not sure I remember exactly what the distinction was.
I think I made the distinction that there is no distinction. I think it depends on what you're going to do with it. If someone's reading it to understand it, that's not likely to be a problem. If someone's reading it to build software using it, that's, I think, from HL7's perspective, a problem. I didn't address the issue of money for the standards. So once you've bought the organizational license, you're in. I mean, I can download anything off the HL7 website anytime, as many times as I want. And frankly, that's worth $1,000 a year to not have to worry about that. Whereas if you're trying to do it some other way and you get nickel and dime to death trying to buy this little piece and that little piece, and you don't get the rights to use it in development that way anyway. So, you know, I think HL7 would like to have a sustainable business model. And I don't know. My sense is that their vision of it does not depend on their selling their products piecemeal. It really does depend on getting organizational membership so that they can support the organization on a consistent basis rather than trying to sell products.
Right. And specifically, the difference between those two guides, the 2.3.1 guide was never copyrighted by HL7,
right,
but it includes HL7 intellectual property. The 2.5.1 guide is copyrighted by HL7 and also includes HL7 intellectual property. So that's the distinction between the two.
Thank you, Austin.
Just real quick.
Are we going to get, I've been trying to talk my state into, well, actually I finally talked them in to becoming a member again. It lapsed and it took me a while to get it renewed. Is there going to be a white paper on some of this stuff that I can present to them and say, hey, if I'm telling a hospital that they're not compliant, they're violating the HL7 standard, I can't really do that.
Right.
So we need to be members. And you know, it's like you said, I agree, it's minuscule what it costs for the waste that there is. Did I say who I was?
Shh.
I don't think I did. Good.
I don't know about a white paper. I think what we've been trying, several of us in public health have been trying to get HL7 to do, is be clear about some of these issues, which would have been, and we tried to get HL7 to sit in this seat, not me. But that hasn't happened yet. So I agree with you that I think it would be very helpful if we had a clear statement that would cover some of these things that could be handed out. But I do think that the copyright violation lever is a much clearer one, and one that contract officers and grants and contracts kind of people are very sensitive to. And so if you say, if we do not do this, we will be in violation of U.S. copyright law and they can come after us. Like I say, it made it a much simpler process for me, and I expect in many governmental organizations that would be the case because they buy licenses. I mean, you don't want to know how long it takes our laptops to boot up because there's all this compliance software on there to make sure that we're only running valid versions, paid for versions of software. So they're such sticklers about that, and yet, you know, that's why, again, I think that if we use that lever within our organizations, it'll make matters easier. I still think that doing it one-off is not as efficient and not as cost-effective as the solutions that we've come to for LOIC and SNOMED. That's my opinion.
And I will say that, you know, it is not that there have been some discussions, not terribly formal. And in fact, perhaps part of our problem is that many of the discussions end up being very informal, so it's hard to know where you are. But let's imagine if we were to value the cost of a public health license you know, the one question is, well, let's see, there's 57 states, districts, territories, yeah. So you multiply that by $1,000 apiece, you know, we shouldn't probably not pay more than $57,000, right? So some of the questions, though, that start circling around then is, when states start dealing with their local jurisdictions, are we in the same situation all over again? One question is, are rights of sustaining members different than rights of the other organizational categories? Because CDC does pay substantially more to the operation of HL7 today than do even commercial organizational members. And then, of course, there is this question, which by my read, not a lawyer's read, but I think my lawyer agrees with me, it's very hazy what the term client and customer mean. So, and I'm not trying to nickel or dime people, although nickel and dime largely describes what I have in my pockets at CDC, having already paid for the sustaining membership. But those are some of the parsing issues that have arisen that we need to somehow get through. Of course, the last issue is it CDC's issue? Is it the issue at HHS or at other levels?
This is slightly off topic, but there are other reasons to join HL7 besides copyright issues. We really give up our right to complain about what's written into those standards if we as public health totally ignore their development. We get a head's-eye view of what's coming down the pike, sometimes decades, well, maybe years ahead of time.
Are we talking about certain development cycles?
We are talking about certain standards that take decades to come to fruition. And we also get an insight into what the standards were supposed to have meant instead of what we construe them to mean. Because they are kind of hard to read unless you are schooled in the art of reading HL7 standards.
Yeah. That was John Roberts, folks from Tennessee, who is one of the current co-chairs of the Public Health and Emergency Response work group within HL7. Thank you, John. And I'll underline that, too, as a former co-chair, that the more public health people that we have at the more different tables, the better the standards development works out for us. That's just how it is. You know, if we're not there to, and we've got some really great champions like Austin, but he can only be in so many places at the same time. Fortunately, he's of late in very powerful places for us, but still, we all, as many of us as can be at the table, and I recognize that that's not going to be possible for everybody, but even if one person from each member jurisdiction, let's just say state to make it short, could pick some part of HL7 that interests them, whether it's electronic lab reporting or case reporting or whatever, and actually follow that and provide input from a public health perspective and vote, it would make a huge difference.
Rita?
Yeah. Erin.
Erin Holt from Tennessee. So we are a NBS state, but we also have other surveillance systems that consume electronic laboratory result reporting, like our STD surveillance system, which receives quite a few EOR messages, and our HIV system, as well as lead and some others. And so we do quite a bit of manipulation, routing, translation, manipulating touching of the information that we get, and we send it to these other systems. And sometimes we're actually down-translating to another HL7 version. So Tennessee is a member, regardless of the fact that we have the NEDS-based system. But we are a member. Okay. And along those same lines, I have to echo what John said. I went to my first HL7 working group meeting in May, and I was really, really after I got past the acronyms and started to understand some of it, but there's so much discussion going on about public health, and there really needs to be more people who are involved in the day-to-day activities of public health there at the table to discuss these sorts of things, to have that kind of input. I can't stress that enough.
I agree. Again, I think that the folks that have been part of the SDOs for a long time have done yeoman's work. I mean, Jim and Austin and others. And CDC has had representatives at the table, but I don't think that's a substitute for having, you know, jurisdictional representation as well.
D-
Just curious, a show of hands of people in the room who believe, first of all, just people who are not parts of organizations, please raise your hands. Okay, so you're all parts of organizations. So how many people in the room believe they belong to an organization that is not a member? Maybe one, maybe two. So, you know, so we are, most of us, members, and we are covered by a variety of overlapping considerations around the use of intellectual property. We are members. We use software that was created by members. We have customers and clients. So one could argue that there's a fairly robust level of protection. I think, again, the big issue is before you go and put something on a website, that's kind of the sticky wicket that seems to be hanging up my agency from time to time and perhaps your own. Are there others that I'm not sensitive to?
I think that's clearly an issue, and it's writ large for CDC because anything you publish will be a national distribution de facto. So you're a bigger target.
And we can't not publish either.
Right. But I'm thrilled that many organizations are members because, as Seth said, in terms of your own development activities, you're then entirely within the rule of law. Okay. Any other questions? Hey, and no Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you.
I want to remind people that somewhere there's an evaluation process, doubtless in the ether somewhere.
Yeah.
So please evaluate today's session, which I suspect you'll have to do to get your continuing education credits.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, the social event starts at 5:30, am I right?
Five.
So okay. But please join us for some fun. Thank you, everybody.